If there is a theme to our culture, it is the theme of I want it and I want it now. And the key and operative word is the word now. You can find it anywhere you want to look. Financially, we are a credit card culture because ultimately the deal is I want it and I want it now. Well, can you pay for it now? Well, of course I can't pay for it now. So how are we going to do it? Well, let me just take it now and I'll pay for it later. How would that be? Well, how are you going to pay for it later? I don't know. I don't live in the neighborhood later. I live in the neighborhood now. And now is pretty much where my address and mail's all delivered. So go ahead and let's do now. And so we do that. We're in a culture of impulse buying. One of the things we do around here is work with some people on budgets. There's a lot of people we work with on budgets. It's a common thing for us to do. Boy, you would think we are chaining them to the third row of a galley slave ship, you know, with oars. I mean, it is so difficult for people to want to live or be able to live within a budget because they will say things like, you mean I have to plan and hold off and restrain and say no, but I have money in my pocket and I could go do it now. I've got money now. I could do it and I want it now. But and you be to lay out and go, but wait a second. Tomorrow, oh yeah, but tomorrow's just so hard. So hard. We have an 800-pound gorilla who demands. Who demands? Do something now. It's not just finances, it's also in worse things, it's in relationships. We're a culture of abandoned relationships because we're in pain now. Well, yeah, but if you'll work hard, if you'll labor, if you'll do the right thing, it will pay off dividends. Here's what will happen tomorrow and for you, the next generation. But I deserve to be happy now. I want to be happy now. And the pain of now is too much. Maybe you're right, but now. And so parents and marriage and children and families, they all pay the price of now. And as if it could get any worse, it still does. See, we're a culture of personal surrender to the ugly troll within me. You see, much like a two-year-old child beating on the table, the troll wants fed now. I want fed now. This spoiled two-year-old, feed me now. And so you look in your own life and you see fears or worries or insecurities, things that must be dealt with and things that ought to be invested in and things that are handled rightly and wisely. But no, now I want fed. Now I want relief. Now I want off the hook. And so we find, do you think most people actually become alcoholics because there's the taste of alcohol? You're so incredibly wrong at that. For the most part, alcohol is ultimately part of how I feed the troll of now. I don't want the pain of living with the world as it is now. I want to feel good. I want to party. I want something that will take me out, entertain me now. Prescription drugs, illegal drugs, the list goes on and on. Now. How about sex before marriage? Oh, we'll all agree that in a theoretical place, boy, that'd be really nice if it didn't happen. But my goodness, the troll demands to be fed now. Feed the troll. Feed the troll. And now. We're a culture that has wired itself for now. We're a world of 30-second sound bites. Give me everything I want to know and give it to me in 30 seconds, but don't hold my attention any longer than that. I want it now. We're a culture of 30-page abridgments and cliff notes. The microwave is not just an instrument in the kitchen. The microwave is a metaphor for our culture. We want fast foods and fast lanes and drive-thrus. We want picture within a picture TV sets. We want picture within a telephone things. We want picture anywhere you can get it. I want it now. The list goes on. We hate stoplights. Oh, we hate stoplights. Stoplights goof up my whole now. There's a dear friend who's probably sitting here looking at me somewhere. Very dear friend, but this very wonderful person hates stoplights so bad that when she sees a stoplight on a road, she will turn right the block before and just go around the block. I may come back right where I came out, but I at least feel like I'm making progress now. And so we don't stop at stoplights.
You've seen her at intersections before.
The creed of this day is pretty simple. The creed of our day is anything worthwhile can be acquired now. And if you can't acquire it now, it's probably not really worthwhile and not worth my attention or interest. And that's what makes it so incredibly hard for some people to live as Christians. That's what makes it so incredibly hard for the Christian message to be incorporated in our culture, because they do not match. In Hebrews, the 10th chapter, verses 32 to 34, there's a description of what the Christian life looks like. The writer of Hebrews goes back to these folks and reminds them of their former days, and he says, I want to give you a snapshot of what the Christian life looks like. Verse 32, remember those earlier days after you'd received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering? Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times, you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those who were in prison, and you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. In a vivid and dynamic and powerful demonstration, he says, the difference between you and the world is this. When you were living faithful, what happened to you in the now had very little impact on you, very little temptation to you. What was happening in the now had very little appeal. In fact, what was happening in the now rocked you very little. And they could confiscate your property now, but who cares? Because what I really possess and what really possesses me lies out there. And you can't steal that. That's the real, the now you can have. The creed of a man of faith is Hebrews 10:23. I do believe Hebrews 10:23 has to be percolated on for a long time. I don't believe it's an easy, quick verse you automatically throw in, but it ought to be as very strong as much to you as John 3:16. You ought to write it on your mirror. You ought to put it in the center of your steering wheel. You ought to write it on every day timer you have. You ought to do something with Hebrews 10:22 and 23 in that set of verses. They are absolutely powerful. Hebrews 10, verse 23 says, let us, personalize it, let me hold unwaveringly to the hope I profess, for he who promised is faithful. Let me hold unswervingly to the hope I profess, for he who promised is faithful. That's the distinct difference between the person who says, let me live in the now. This is about someone who says, let me set my eyes not just on the future, but let me set my eyes on the one who holds the future, and the now will lose its power. I believe it was John Piper who tells this story. If it wasn't him, I at least give him credit for it. He describes that his grandparents were in Norway, and it was difficult to picture as a husband and wife how they could raise their children, their many children, and have the kind of life they wanted for their family and for their children's families. And it looked to them like it was a dead end on what they had. So the dad took several years and labored like crazy. He worked day and night. He worked multiple jobs. And while they were poor, he scraped together what would be the equivalent of almost 2 years' worth of money to pay for food and almost 2 years' worth to pay for rent on a house. It wasn't quite enough, but almost. When he had scraped together enough for 2 years, he put the money in the hands of his wife and his 10 children, and he walked out the door and hitchhiked to America. Caught boats and ships and whatever he could do, and he got to America. He became a laborer in Pennsylvania. Now, his story has more to it, but you come back here. What happens to a family when the pantry begins to empty in front of them? What happens to a family when just the daily pressing needs begin to seem so overwhelming? Well, what happens when the neighbors begin to say, look, this isn't working for you guys. There's so many men abandon their families and don't come back. You have pressing needs now. The older two boys my uncle will take, he needs farm laborers in northern Norway. Let him go to them. And the younger girls, they could live. Those two girls could go live because she just lost her daughter and she would like to have. And so every day you had to gather around your family and say, we're not breaking our family up and we're not splitting apart and we are going to hold on. And on a regular basis, you had to say, your father, if he is still alive, your father will keep his promise. Your father is a man of honor. And one day, it was almost 2 years later, unannounced. He came walking in the road. And when he came in, he had worked day and night in multiple jobs in Pennsylvania till he had enough money. And he came back and picked up his wife and 10 children. And John Piper writes, "And our families became Americans. And our family got a new start in a new land. Because my grandfather was a man of honor and kept his promises. And my grandmother was a woman who stood unwavering in her faith." This Hebrews, the 11th chapter that we're about to go into, is about that kind of thing. We are those children around that table. We are that spouse in some ways waiting for that bridegroom. And the question that really comes out of this text is, do you wait with faith? Do you know how to live by faith, or have you been captured by the now? Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 said, you better know what faith is, because without faith, it's impossible to please God. Meaning what? Meaning there may be many marvelous attributes in your life, wonderful things that you have, but if God doesn't find faith in you, none of those attributes mean a hill of beans. It also means your life may have lots of bumps and bruises and things that didn't go the way you wanted them to, and things that kind of break your own heart at times. But do not despair. If God finds faith in your heart, you are still pleasing to God, and there is more joy in that word faith than you could ever imagine. Faith. What is faith? That's actually a real problem, quite frankly. Faith has been so neutered in our culture and used in so many ways. The word faith has been put to everything, kind of the way the word low-fat's been put to everything. I mean, it means nothing after a while. Low-fat Twinkies, you know, I really like those, you know, sort of thing. Low-fat, you know, whatever. The list goes on and on and on. And at some point in time, you're going, well, what does faith mean? In our culture, there are three wrong definitions for faith, three bad definitions. Biblically, none of these will work, but these three float in our culture. The first wrong definition for faith in this culture is basically faith is nothing more than just a synonym for optimism. Optimism. I believe, and I'm optimistic, and I'm optimistic, and I'm optimistic. I'm not mad at anybody in one family. In fact, I'm not even picking one family out of my mind when I tell this, because it's happened so many times through the years, and I don't want to embarrass anybody. But every now and then, you'll find this scenario. Somebody in the family will get cancer, and we're dealing with a real live situation that has difficulties. And so you'll go by, maybe you're a neighbor, maybe you're a friend, maybe you're somebody on staff here, and you go by to check with them, and you say, what are we going to do about the... And you start to get the word cancer out, and they just cut you off. We don't use that word in here. We don't use that word. We're just believing. We're just believing it's not there. We're believing it'll be gone. We're just believing it'll never be there. And we don't use... No negativity here. In fact, all negativity stops at the door. We are people of faith. We just believe, and we have faith. And you realize what they've done is they've gone to the dictionary and cut out about 30 words and said, okay, we're going to live our life without those 30 words. Okay? And we're not even going to think those words. All right? We have faith. That's not faith, gang. That's not faith. It may be a lot of things, but it's not faith. But there are some people who say there's a God out there and there's a heaven and he loves us, and when we die, we'll all go to heaven and I'll open my eyes and I'll be in the pasture and my old horse Flicker will be there and my dog that died when I was three and the goldfish we flushed down the stool will be there, and I mean, we'll all be there and how do you know? Well, because I just believe. I don't allow for negativity. I have faith. You're about half loony, but you got faith. There's a second definition for faith our culture uses, and that second definition is we use subjective religious experience. Faith is nothing more than a religious experience. Your mom had passed away, and later on you were going through her effects, and as you picked up her Bible, a feather kind of came drifting out of it, and a full moon went by, and the wind blew across, and suddenly a butterfly went through your stomach, and goosebumps went up in the back of your neck, and something, lightning struck, and something occurred, and you can't describe it. You wished you could tell people what it was like, but something happened, and when we say, do you have faith? You say, oh yeah, man, I'm telling you, I remember vividly that day that I've got faith. well, why aren't you living a life of faith? Oh, don't tell me I don't have faith. I'm going to tell you the day. Let me tell you about that feather and the wind blew and the full moon and the, you know, and the butterfly hit my liver and, you know, I mean, it just, whoo, boy, some, I mean, even now to this day, it just causes me, I am a person of faith. No. No, you just define faith as a religious experience. There are a couple problems with that. What do you do when you don't remember as vividly? Have you lost faith? And what happens if that's never happened to you? Maybe you wanted to have faith, but boy, it just never, I don't know, the lightning never hit, and I don't know. Maybe God didn't want me to have faith. There's a third definition for faith that floats around, and it's also pretty crazy, but the third definition for faith is that faith is having the right orthodox answers to the right orthodox questions. And if you can fill in the right questions to the right answers, then that's faith. So tomorrow night, we'll go out to one of the worst bars here in Joplin, and we'll go around until we find a table, about half South guys, and we will put out our religious questionnaire. We have 14 or 15 key questions. Key questions. And these half-wit guys will take in their half-drunkenness and fill out the questionnaire. And you pick it up and go, well, I'll be. I have never seen such faith. Because they answered all 15 questions with the right orthodox view. They believe that God exists. They believe Jesus is the Son of God. They believe He died on the cross. They believe He's coming back. They believe that, here's the evidence of faith. And so we define, there's some folks here that, quite frankly, if we ask, are you living by faith, he would say, yeah, I still believe the right things. None of those three definitions are biblical. In fact, I would go so far as to tell you the Pharisees, as a quick illustration, believe the right things. Jesus even said, listen to what they teach. Don't do what they do. No. Now, there's a biblical definition that you have to put your hands around. I feel sorry for people from the world who come into a church because they want to know what a life of faith is, and they find a menagerie here, or they find a zoo. There are four groups in any church. There are people who hold a biblical faith, and there are the other three groups, and they're all mixed together. No wonder the world gets confused. What is biblical faith? What's it look like? Let's go into Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, God not only illustrates, but He defines what faith is. That definition goes like this. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. Now, it's going to take us a little bit of time. Please do some hard work with me on this for a moment. There are no funny stories or illustrations or anything. We stay with me for a second. We got to work into this one. What's this first mean? Don't give it a first blush and go right on by it. There are two key words that will define what faith is. They set up the whole verse. Those two key words, in the New International Version, it's the word sure and the word certain. Faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. There's another version some of you have in your lap that says faith is the assurance of things hoped for. It is the conviction of things not seen. Oh, what's that mean? I think you have to go back a little bit deeper and do a little word study on those two words. In fact, even if you were doing your Greek translation, if you had a Greek Bible in front of you translated into English, you would find that you'd have to stop for a second on Hebrews 11, 1 and have to mull on it because he uses a funny combination of words. The first Greek word is the word hypostasis. And it doesn't in itself mean anything to you, but let me tell you, the King James Version got pretty close. When the King James Version used the word substance. Now, faith is the substance. That Greek word literally means that which stands beneath. That which stands beneath. It was used for a solid foundation. It was used for a place to stand. It was used for solid ground. And so the logical punch of the word is that faith is the substance or solid ground we stand on when we hope. Faith is the solid ground or foundation we stand on when we hope. Faith is not the word of wishful thinking. It's not the word of standing on a lily pad that's kind of pretty much, it's not somehow taking a blind leap off out in the dark, just going, boy, I just want to believe something. Faith is the solid rock you stand on while you hope. The second key word is a Greek legal term. It's a word that means certainty or proof. It's a word that was used for evidence. And so when the prosecuting attorney would go to the trial and he would lay out in front of them, here's the smoking gun, they would say, ah, there's the evidence. Now you take a funny thing in this. He puts these words together then. Words that don't seem to fit together. For example, he says, now faith is the substance, the real concrete substance of what we hope for. Now faith is the evidence, the proof of the thing we do not see. If I were to put it in my own verbiage, I would describe it this way. I think the intent of the verse is this. Faith is standing here with a logical reason to hope for something. Faith is standing here waiting for something I do not yet see, but I have a good reason to do so. It is a combination of substance and hope, evidence, and things I do not see. Now, I can hear the skeptic. I mean, you can hear the skeptic when the writer of Hebrews would have written this. The skeptic going, man, it's crazy to believe in something you cannot see. It's crazy to believe that something you cannot see could ever become real. The writer of Hebrews must have had a twinkle in his eye when he wrote the next verse. Because the writer responds, I know of something. I know of something you couldn't see or feel. That had you been there at the time and in the now, you would have said, why, there is nothing here. Why, nothing could come from this. There is nothing. And the writer of Hebrews says, I know a solid rock you stand on. I know a foundation and a substance you stand on. I know the evidence for something that can be made out of nothing. And in verse 3, he says, by faith we understand the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Tuesday, we were in Kansas City and I was holding a grandchild in my lap. So I didn't pay much attention to the news that night, but I had the TV on for a moment. Baby Einstein occupies a lot of our time. But anyhow, I'm holding this grandchild and we're flipping through and they were, this week you'll notice they were doing a lot of stuff with NASA, with space flights and all those sort of things. And they did a little deal. It was just one that's just, it's just humorous. I mean, I don't care how you cut it, it's still humorous. Because they were having this debate. It wasn't about that particular flight. It's just about the creation of the world. And there was a group that was doing, it's just pseudoscience, but it's a group that comes out of the whole circle of evolution, which says, now, in the beginning, was there nothing, and the nothing produced energy, and the energy produced matter, or in the beginning, was there nothing, and the nothing, I mean, or was there energy when it started, or was there never a time when there wasn't anything, so there always just always was, and it was like a bunch of third grade blind kids trying to figure something out when you're going, you know what? The only logical answer you can come to is there was a time there was nothing and God spoke in the place that there was nothing. And when he spoke in the place there was nothing, you're standing on the solid rock that would cause you to say he can always bring something out of nothing. The very evidence of my faith is the ground I stand on. And he uses creation as the basis for everything else he has to say. I am not being somebody who's stupid, standing off in a vacuum in space, going, I'm just going to hope something happens. Instead, I'm the very person who is standing on the rock we call home. And where did it come from? The very one who did what you said he can't. He starts off the evidence. Let me just throw this in, and I know the time's running on us badly, but every now and then somebody says, boy, I just wish I could work up more faith. I wished I had more faith. I wished I had faith like you have, or, you know, Jay has, or somebody has. Boy, I just wished I had more faith. And I've worked on it. I've tried to whip it up, but I just couldn't get it. Can I remind you that faith is not whipped up out of thin air? He writes in Romans 1. He writes in the Psalms. He writes everywhere. I want you to take a good hard look at creation. It is the evidence and the rock you'll stand on. I want you to stand and look very hard at the resurrection. I want you to stand and look at the truth of the resurrection. I want you to read the eyewitness accounts. I want you to see the archaeological evidence. I want you to look at the things throughout history I've done. I want you to know what the eyewitnesses said about the raising of the little boy. And I want you to know about all those who saw Lazarus. I want you to know faith comes based on truth. And if you're having trouble having faith, there's a very good chance you haven't looked at the truth in a while. And the truth will be the basis by which faith has a substance for things that you then hope for and an evidence for things you cannot yet see. I remember the day I was in senior in high school. I was upstairs in my bedroom in my parents' house. And I had stood on this side of the line that I trust Jesus because a whole crowd stood there and my parents stood there and all kinds of people stood there. But I had a friend who sort of challenged me, and I realized I wasn't sure which side of the line I wanted to stand on. I thought I had a science mind. I remember the day that I was reading through biblical evidence that I had not really spent time in before, and tears running down my cheeks when I realized there's a place my faith stands. It's on the truth. And the day I chose for myself which side of the line of sand I wanted to stand on because of the evidence. Do not see faith as something that's just whipped out of nothing. There are those who got it. Abel got it. Enoch got it. Abraham got it. Abraham is told to go to a place that he's never seen before, a place he has no idea the land's there. God says, let me take you on this pilgrimage. And Abraham said, okay, I'll go. I trust you. And he says, God, you come on down to verse 13 through 16. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They didn't receive the things promised, at least not in this lifetime. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show they're looking for a country of their own. If they'd been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. He's prepared a city for them. The now didn't own these folks. Their eyes were set on a further horizon. I love the story beyond the shadow of a doubt. In this text about Moses, look at verse 24 of chapter 11. In chapter 11, verse 24, by faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. If you were Moses growing up as the daughter of Pharaoh's son, tell me, what were the bands of those days, the popular bands? What concerts could you go to? Tell me, if you were the son of Pharaoh's daughter, tell me, what were the latest chariots and what did they look like? How quick could Detroit pump them out? How fast were the horses? If you were the son of Pharaoh's daughter, tell me, what kind of women would throw themselves at you? What kind of access would you have to sexual conquest as the son of Pharaoh's daughter? Tell me, what kind of pharmaceutical events had Egypt come up with? What kind of things could you take that would make you feel better? What kind of houses could you build? What kind of power could you have? Tell me what life was like for a 19-year-old man and the world of Egypt lay in front of you. And Moses said, I will not be captured by the now. And he said no to the pleasures of Egypt because he believed the promises of God. And I will endure suffering in the now.
We're in a culture that builds itself around the things you can see, around the car and the house and the lake and the money and the mall and the stadium and the applause and the votes and the rewards.
And we see them. And the world says, I will grab them and live there.
The Christian says, I'm an alien and a stranger here. I'm a pilgrim. I'm on a different journey. I will not stop and put my tent here. I will not drive the tent pegs down. The car, the house, the lake, the money, the malls, the stadium, the applause, the votes,
I will walk by them and deal with them entirely different. The world will laugh and mock and jeer. The world will say you're missing out. The world will say you just blew it. The world will call me crazy and stupid. But I am not here to possess the now. He who owns the future and the possession he has promised. I stand on the side of the line in the sand who believes that God told the truth.
In Hebrews 11, Verse 32 to verse 39 is just some of the most moving passages you'll ever read. But I want to start in verse 35.
He's talking about those who got it.
It refers to verse 35. Women received back their dead, raised to life. Others were tortured and refused to be released. They might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put to death. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskin and goatskin and destitute and persecuted and mistreated. And the world wasn't worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground because the now I am willing to sacrifice and surrender because he who promised is faithful. I will not live in this world as this world does. Either God has your heart and you believe his promises, or the world of now has your heart. If you believe God and he has his promises, and he has your heart, there will be blessings in your life. But there will also be cost and suffering and hold on. And it's a long obedience in the same direction. Being a church, it's not hard. Hear me, this is worded right. Being a church, it's not hard to get people to listen to the gospel message. You can get people interested to listen to the gospel message. But it's terribly hard to get them to sustain that interest. People will come to our church because the now is so beating them up and pressuring them that they want answers for the now. And the worship experience or something they may get now will drive them to a church. But there's little market for a life of wait and a life of suffering and a life of surrender and a life of living as an alien. Yes, we as Christians will always deal with the car and the house and the lake, but we will deal with it differently. You will spend your money differently. You will live in holiness differently. You will forgive differently. Everything will be different. And if your life is not lived differently, the troll of now may own more of your heart than you care to admit. Praise team, you can go ahead and come. Those that are delivering the afternoon snacks, you're welcome to bring in and bring those. I want to finish with this. Eugene Peterson wrote a book several years ago, 20, 25 years ago, entitled A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. It's about a pilgrimage. It's about the concept of I will not be distracted. But what he writes is so good, I'd like to read you a portion of it. He says it this way. I will edit, by the way, a little bit as I'm going through this. I'll change a word or two because he uses some words with more than three syllables. He says, the walk of the Christian life is hazardous. You see, every day I put faith on the line. I've never seen God. In a world where nearly everything can be weighed, explained, quantified, subjected to analysis, scientific control, I still persist in making the center of my life a God who I have not seen. There's a risk there. Every day I put hope on the line. I don't know one thing about the future. I don't know what the next hour will hold. There may be sickness or accident or personal or world catastrophe. Before this day is over, I may have to deal with death or pain or loss or rejection. I don't know what the future holds for me, for those I love, for my nation, for this world. Still, despite my ignorance, I still say that God will accomplish his will. And I cheerfully persist in living in the hope that nothing will ever separate me from the love of Christ. Every day I put love on the line. There is nothing I am less good at than love. I am far better in competition than love. I am far better at responding to my instincts and ambitions to get ahead and make my mark than I am figuring out how to love somebody. I am schooled and I am trained in the skills of acquisition and getting my own way. And yet I must decide every day to set aside what I can do best and attempt to do what I'm very clumsy at, open myself to the frustrations and failure of loving
and daring to believe that failing in love is better than succeeding in pride. I could go on and on, but the truth is, living as a Christian is hazardous work.
Brings me back to Hebrews 10:23.
Am I willing to step over here and say I will do what looks foolish and stupid to all the rest of the world and would look foolish to me if I did not know the character of the one who promised? And I will live my life unwavering and unswerving around the hope I profess, because he who promised is faithful. Where are your scars, brothers and sisters? Where are your scars of living faithfully? We are the children who wait. If you're not a Christian this morning, I would say to you, we'd love to study with you. We'd love to show you. We'd love to talk with you. Don't walk out of here if you're not a Christian. This world of now will consume you. And you'll have missed the God who laid out a whole journey that you just didn't accept. We want to study with you. If you're not a Christian, you come forward. Jay, Kevin, myself, some of the elders, we'd love to study with you. If you're a Christian this morning, but you've been living a compromised, sold out kind of life to the troll of now, if you live in such a lukewarm faith that nobody recognizes it as biblical faith, we'd like to talk to you. Would you stand as we sing?